Hey guys, it's Albert. We're coming to you on location this week. We got a great show for you guys. We're going to kick things off by addressing the Drew Brees news in the takeaways. Then we got a great guest to get you ready for the 2020 NFL Draft. And as always, we answer all of your questions in the mailbag. Let's go. All right, we're here. We're not in Massachusetts. We're not in New York. I'm actually coming to you from Jupiter, Florida this week. Every year, my family and I sort of go on a quasi-vacation here where I'm still working, but my family's down here, and so we're doing the same thing for you here. The quality of show, I hope, isn't going to be any different than it normally is. We're just in a much warmer climate. It's the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. And we are going to give you a fantastic guest this week to get you ready for next week's Combine. We're going to get all your questions in the mailbag. But we're kicking things off with the takeaways. And my number one takeaway from this week, Drew Brees coming back for a 20th NFL season. Great news for the Saints. Great news for football fans everywhere. Really remarkable that you got two quarterbacks in Brees and Brady who played against each other in the late 90s in the Big Ten. They're still going up against each other in the NFL 2 decades later. Pretty incredible. I think Brees still has some bullets left in the gun. It's going to be fun to watch how the Saints and how Sean Payton adjusts a little bit as Drew Brees, you know, continues to get a little bit older, how they could use Taysom Hill. So really, to me, there are two things that you want to address here. Number one, there's that last part that I said, like that. How do you deploy him? How do you get the most out of Drew Brees? Are you going to have a little bit of a different quarterback situation next year? So, like, to look at that, you got to look at the global view of the Saints quarterback situation. Teddy Bridgewater, I would say, is probably gone. He'll at least explore his options as an unrestricted free agent now. That leaves Taysom Hill. You put a first-round tender on Taysom Hill, it's going to cost you about $5 million. I don't think another team is going to come and give Taysom Hill a big contract and fork over a first rounder for him. So I think you can at least hit the pause button on all the hype with Taysom Hill over the last few weeks. Bring back Taysom Hill for another year. Find a way to incorporate him in the offense. Learn a little bit more about him as a quarterback and have him be sort of an effective counterpoint to Drew Brees. Something that, you know, the Saints really tried to do in that wild card playoff round game. So there's that part of it where I think you probably find a way to just sort of pause the decision on Taysom Hill, whether he's your future. He's going to be going into his age 30 season this year. Obviously, you know, earlier last year, you didn't see fit to play him. You know, when Drew Brees got hurt, when you had that 5-6 week window, it was Teddy Bridgewater going in there, not Taysom Hill. So, you know, now I think you kind of get an idea, a better idea of who Taysom Hill is as a quarterback, and you can also use him in certain ways that'll help you keep Drew Brees effective. So there's that piece of it. The second piece of it, well, if you're the Saints, why is it great to get Drew Brees back? Here's the reason why. Like, you drafted exceptionally well 2016, 2017, 2018. You've got a really, really nice young core of players there. Like David Onyemata is a great example of a guy who's going to probably cash in this offseason. I think get a big contract from someone. The Saints probably won't be able to keep him. But you look, he's part of that 2016 draft class that got you Sheldon Rankins and got you Michael Thomas. In 2017, you've got Ryan Ramczyk, Marshawn Lattimore, Marcus Williams, Alvin Kamara. In 2018, you've got Marcus Davenport, Tre'Quan Smith, who I believe is going to grow into a pretty good receiver. You've got a lot of young talent in the roster. You've got a lot of that young talent still on rookie deals, and you're still in that sweet spot where you were able to be a little bit more aggressive with your veteran acquisitions. You know, you've still got some really good young players on rookie deals, so you're still like right there. And do you want to turn that over? Like, this sweet spot that you're in, do you want to turn that over to another quarterback, or do you want to stick with what you know, a guy who's been an all-timer for you? I think the answer is you stick with the all-timer. Takeaway number two. Like I told you guys earlier, like I told you guys weeks ago, the Tom Brady, I guess, overreaction train is rolling. It left the station a while ago. It's going 100 miles an hour now. I would expect this will be the way that it'll continue. I do think we're coming to an important piece of this, though. Like, when we get to the scouting combine next week, a couple things happen. Number one, this is where Don Yee, Steve Dubin, his representatives, are going to be able to at least ascertain what Brady might be worth, what teams might be interested, And that'll allow Brady to get a better idea of what his options are and what he might be able to do when we get to the middle of March. So if Brady doesn't have a pretty clear idea of what the landscape's going to look like out there for him by March 2nd, like the non-Patriots landscape's going to look like for him, then his agents aren't doing their job. His agents should have a pretty good idea of what the landscape looks like coming out of the combine. I know it's technically against the rules and everything else, but you should have an idea coming out of the combine of what your high-profile client is looking at or is going to be looking at on March 16th when the tampering period starts, then March 18th when unrestricted free agency begins. Number two, this to me is a critical point for the Patriots too. If you look back over the course of the last decade, he's done a handful of extensions or contract adjustments with the team. And two of the bigger ones were done right at the scouting combine. Well, why is that? Because normally teams do their planning, free agent planning, draft planning, their strategic stuff ahead of the combine. And that's why you have a lot of teams starting to make pitches to agents on free agents and teams having like a better idea what they're going to do draft-wise at the combine because they've just come out of those meetings. And so I think by now the Patriots internally at least, and this is going to be a very small group of people that are involved in this, probably Belichick, Casario, and the Crafts, have an idea of what their strategy is going to be with Tom Brady. And I think now what you see is the Patriots make a pitch at the combine or around the combine, and it won't necessarily be in Indianapolis, but around this time, make a pitch to Tom Brady. Here's what we were thinking. Here's what we think we can do. If you want to go to free agency and test your value more than you're right, we understand you wanting to do that. We also would like to tell you that if you do that, there's some risk involved and that we have to look at fallback options as well. And so we can't just be in a situation where we're going to find ourselves without a quarterback. And so I think when we come out of the combine, the communication between the Patriots and the Brady camp should have ramped up at least a little bit. And if it hasn't, then that, of course, would be, I think, a pretty significant red flag. Number three, takeaway number three. Joe Burrow should absolutely explore his options over the next few weeks. Look, very few players are in this position where they're the presumptive number one overall pick going into the scouting combine. And I think the reason why it's incumbent on Joe Burrow to do this for himself, for his future, is because if you look, the quarterbacks who've been successful, the quarterbacks who've been most successful, the young quarterbacks who've been most successful over the last, say, 5 years are in some ways a product of their environment, right? So, and I'm not saying these guys aren't good players. They are. But if you look at the difference between the guys who've made it and the guys who don't, like a lot of it has to do with stability. And you look at Carson Wentz. He's had one head coach. He's had one general manager picking the players. He's had like a star-studded offensive line, Lane Johnson, Jason Peters, Brandon Brooks, Jason Kelsey. He's generally had good, at least good, skill position talent to throw to. Zach Ertz, of course, Brent Celek for a while. More recently, Dallas Goedert at tight end. Alshon Jeffrey, Nelson Aguilar, like not great, but like definitely passable options at receiver. Like he's had a good environment around him. Patrick Mahomes, he's playing for Andy Reid. He has had Matt Nagy. Now he's got Eric Bieniemy as his coordinator. He has had fantastic offensive line help. Eric Fisher and Mitch Schwartz are his tackles. You look at the skill position talent, that goes without saying. Tyree Kill, Sammy Watkins, this year Mecole Hardman. These guys have gone into solid, stable environments. Even if you go on down the line, Jared Goff, he started working with Sean McVay in year two. He's had stability since then. He's had good offensive lines in front of him since then. That might be changing now, which had something to do with why he didn't play as well this year. Deshaun Watson. Yes, they've had the offensive line problems, but he's been throwing to DeAndre Hopkins. He's had Bill O'Brien as his head coach throughout. That's a quarterback. That's a quarterback-centric head coach. So, like, you look at the guys who've made it. Like, there's that. Now look at the guys who haven't. Marcus Mariota, Jameis Winston. Those guys have had multiple coordinators. Those guys have had multiple head coaches. There's just, to me, like, stability is really, really important. And so I think Joe Burrow needs to do as much as he can to learn the situation that's in front of him in Cincinnati as he possibly can. On the flip side, I do think Cincinnati can play into a relationship here. I mentioned this in a column last week. There's a relationship there between the Burrow family and Zach Taylor. Burrow's dad, Joe Burrow's dad, Jimmy Burrow, was the defensive coordinator at Nebraska. Both of Joe Burrow's brothers played at the University of Nebraska. So there's a connection there. Zach Taylor and Jimmy Burrow got to know each other a little bit on the recruiting trail when Joe Burrow was at when Jimmy Burrow was at Nebraska and Zach Taylor was at the University of Cincinnati. There's a lot of just commonality there. And so I think it would make sense for the Bengals to pull on that lever to try to convince Joe Burrow. And you're going to see how well thought of Joe Burrow is in a minute when we bring our special guest in. It's incumbent on the Bengals to pull on those connections. Number four, the Mason Rudolph, Myles Garrett situation won't go away. Myles Garrett going on outside the lines, saying to Mina Kimes what he said, that reiterating that a racial slur was used out in the field. In November, when Myles Garrett swung the helmet at Mason Rudolph, wound up getting suspended for 6 games. Mason Rudolph, of course, firing back, that is 1,000% false. And his coach, Mike Tomlin, coming out emphatically defending him and saying that he knows people in the Browns organization. He has relationships there. Not only did he not hear from any of his players, but he didn't hear from anybody in the Browns organization that happened back when it happened. And so this is a fascinating situation going forward. I think one way or another, we know something awful happened, right? Either the racial slur was used, and that's obviously awful, or the racial slur wasn't used and Myles Garrett is falsely accusing somebody of that, which is, I would argue, just as bad, because that's something that you can't get off of you. That's something that, like, that's a scarlet letter. That's going to be a problem for Mason Rudolph going forward for the rest of his NFL career. And it's so unfair for someone to pull that lever on someone just to sort of, you know, it's sort of like, it can't be like people's get out of jail free card. Like, oh, I did something horrible, so I'm going to say that this caused it. And like, now it's going to be seen in a different light. You just, to me, it's like, it's just as bad if you're pulling that lever and branding somebody that way, or trying to brand somebody that way. It's every bit as bad as what Myles Garrett accused Rudolph of doing. So to me, like, this is awful, awful one way or the other. Finally, takeaway number five, Darius Slay's name getting out there again on the trade market. I think we're going to see a little bit more trade activity over the next couple of weeks. It's going to be interesting to see what happens ahead of the new league year. Obviously, a lot of people will be watching some of the teams out there that have new coaches. What do the Panthers do with Cam Newton? That's an interesting one. Do they have some other veteran players in the roster that they might want to shed that maybe don't fit what Matt Rhule wants quite as much? That'll be interesting to watch. Redskins with Ron Rivera, the Browns with Kevin Stefanski. So it's going to be interesting to watch what happens on the trade market with those teams. And this is an example of why Darius Slay maybe isn't the best cultural fit for what Matt Patricia's been building in Detroit. And yeah, they weren't good last year, but if you look at the beginning of the year, you were seeing a team that was more on board. And one of the reasons why they got rid of Quandre Diggs when they did is because he wasn't a cultural fit. And they really believed in what they had done over the first 5 or 6 weeks of the season, what they'd been able to accomplish. Now, of course, the quarterback gets hurt and everything changes. But, you know, I do think that there's that feeling out there. There's that feeling out there that that he wasn't like the right, like Diggs, Slay, they weren't the right fit. So that's the Slay side of it, is that, you know, you, all right, now you're trying to trade Slay. Does he want a new contract from his new team? Does that make it harder to trade him? He's only got a year left at $10.5 million, which is affordable. So if you are trading him on his current contract, there's some value there. There's a lot of different pieces of that. But, you know, of course, like, now he's going to be a name that's going to be out there. Do we see other players that aren't cultural fits where they are? Is Odell Beckham a cultural fit for what Kevin Stefanski's building? Is Cam Newton a cultural fit for what Matt Rhule's building? There's lots of open questions there with some of the new coaches that I think you can take the Slay situation, you can apply those to that. And you guys can hear now, that was actually, there's like this little pool area in the house that we rented, so you guys can hear the water coming down there. Just some scene stuff for you guys from where we're at right now in Florida, which again is much nicer right now than Massachusetts or New York are. And with that, we're going to throw it over to our special guest for the week. All right, well, the combine's just a few days away. And so to get you guys ready for the combine, I want to bring in one of my good friends in the business and a guy who I think is best in the business when it comes to getting everybody ready for the combine. Former Ravens scout, former Brown scout, former Eagle scout. And now for the last, what is it, DJ, 7 or 8 years, he's been one of the lead guys at NFL Network. The last couple years, the lead guy at NFL Network. Daniel Jeremiah, welcome in.
How you doing, brother? Man, it's been fun kind of getting through all this prep for the combine. It feels like every year, about maybe 2 weeks out from the combine, you think, like, I'm not going to get there. I'm not going to be able to get all this done. And then somehow we magically always end up where we need to be by the time we get to Indy.
So where are you at now? How many players are you going to get through, and how many players are you actually through?
So my goal, you know, having sat in kind of that lead chair last year for the first time, my goal was coming into that combine, I wanted to have done and watched and studied all 330 whatever players it is. So by the time we get to Indy, which is an incredible crunch to get that done, but it does free up a little bit after the combine to really hone in on the top tier players. So right now in the process, Albert, I've got everything done except for about, I think I have about maybe 15 or 18 DBs left. So I'm done with every other position. I've got the grades in, all that good stuff. So I'll have those DBs done by the end of this weekend, and we'll be ready to roll once we get to Indy.
How much of each guy are you watching? Like, how many games of each guy would you say you have? I know you're probably watching more of the top guys than some of the fringe guys. Like, how much of each guy are you actually watching?
Well, that's what's cool about technology. With some of the stuff we have now, with the ability to, I try and watch a couple games, and then after that, instead of watching, getting to four games, on some players, some guys I might watch two games, and then if it's a corner, I can go in through the video and sort every single time he was targeted. So you want to see how a guy plays the football, I can watch every single one for the whole season. With wide receivers, I can see all the targets, all the balls that went to them through the whole year. There's some like offensive line, defensive line, there's really no shortcut there. You got to just kind of grind through your three games and, or more, depending on if you're not comfortable with the player. But it does vary, but I can tell you, man, it's got infinitely better and easier on scouts, and then to be able to have that technology to rely on is huge. I mean, even on defensive linemen, where now we can sort it where just the plays were there in the game. So if you're normally having to crank through and watch 80 plays and he plays 45 plays, well, that's a time suck. But now you can sort it and just watch the 45 plays that particular player is on the field. So long story short, it's gotten a lot more efficient with the growth of technology.
Okay, so like based on what you've seen so far, what would you say the mark of this class is? Like, you know, I know sometimes there's an elite class, and maybe there's a dozen players who are blue chip, and that'll stick out. And then there are other years where like the third or fourth round's really strong, or maybe there's one position strong, another position that's strong. What would you say after, you know, looking at 300 some odd players is the mark of this year's class?
I think there's pretty good depth. I think, look, the headliner to me is still the receiver position, because it's the best receiving group in terms of the depth of talent that I've ever seen. So I started scouting in 2003. I don't remember going this deep with quality players to the point where I think I had 22, 23 players with top three round grades, something like that. I mean, it was, there's a lot of really, really good receivers in all different shapes and sizes, depending on what you need. That to me is kind of the biggest takeaway watching all these guys, but I think it's a really deep, solid group of running backs. I think you look at the corner positions, got some real depth. Defensive line is solid, especially on the interior, more so than the edge rushers in terms of the depth. Linebacker, I didn't feel great about that coming into this, from what you kind of heard, but when I dug in and studied it, I thought it was pretty good. So there's a lot of these positions. Offensive tackle is another one, really good depth. If you're looking for kind of, where the weak spot is, I don't think it's a great group of tight ends. That would probably be the first one. And then safety wise, I don't think there's, a tremendous amount of quality depth at the safety position. So those are some of the big takeaways. But I think when you get into the third, fourth round of this draft and you want to find, particularly offensive skill guys, you're going to like what you see.
So you said, like let's hone in on the receivers, because you said, what, 22, 23 guys with top three round grades. Like, what would a normal year be? Like what would the number be like in an average year at receiver?
You know, I have to go back and look, but I would say you're probably talking about, you know, 12 to 14, somewhere around there, 15 maybe, you know, and this is an extraordinary year when you get to the depth of it. So, yeah, it's definitely different. It's a good idea, though. I should go back. I can go back and calculate that and see how many of those grades I have in previous years. But this one is definitely deep.
That seems extraordinary. I mean, like that difference. I mean, it's what? I mean, maybe 10 guys, like more of that quality. I sort of got in the sense, though, that maybe there isn't like a Julio, an AJ Green, a Calvin Johnson, like, but there's a lot of guys that are maybe the next tier. Is that a fair way to look at it? Or do you think there's one or two of these guys that may be capable of being that sort of player?
Well, I mean, I think when you traditionally look at guys that are the top five picks, you know, like the big time top five, I would say even top 10, the Calvin Johnsons, the Julio Jones, these are height, weight, speed freaks that are great football players. We don't have that in this draft. Like the top receivers for me, none of the three are huge guys. You know, when you look at the two guys from Alabama and Judy and Ruggs, and you look at CeeDee Lamb, and none of them are as physically imposing as a Julio or as a Calvin Johnson. They're great players. You know, great route runners. You know, obviously you get the big time speed with Ruggs, but in terms of all in one package, the height, weight, speed, as well as just being a great football player, we don't have that Megatron type guy, but man, you've got, you know, that 1B group of receivers is really, really good.
So do you think it could wind up hurting the top guys like a little bit, like in that maybe a team that's drafting in the top 10 says, okay, I want to go get an offensive tackle here. And so I'm going to draft my offensive tackle knowing, like, I don't need to draft Jerry Jeudy with the 8th or 9th or 10th pick because I can get a pretty good player in the 2nd or 3rd round.
Yeah, and I think recent history, when you go back, and I've talked to a couple general managers that have actually have done this and referenced this, when you go back and study the last handful of drafts and you look at the 2nd and 3rd round wide receivers, so basically the day 2 wide receivers versus the day 1 wide receivers, there's a lot of evidence to support the fact that you should just wait. Just wait till you get into round 2 and 3, because you're going to find the Michael Thomases, the DJ Charks, the Debo Samuels. You know, we saw the two kids from Ole Miss last year that had just phenomenal some rookie seasons. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of teams that are going to end up picking up on that theory of let's get the big guys now. With the depth of the wide receiver group, there's going to be guys we really like there in the 2nd and even 3rd round. So I think that's, you know, it's going to be interesting, because I could see where we come to this draft and everybody goes, well, all this hype about the wide receivers, but they, you know, we only had, you know, 3 or 4 go in the 1st round after all that hype. I think they almost a chance they could be punished for just the amount of depth, the quality depth in this class.
Do you think like Jeudy or Lamb or are those receivers you can build around then? Like, are those true number one receivers, or are those more like a really good player who's just going to sort of fit into your overall picture?
No, I think when you talk about Jeudy and Lamb, like, they are high volume number one receivers, you know, 100 catch guys, you know, perennial, you know, 1200 plus yard seasons. Like, they're legit number ones. And I think when you look at Ruggs, it's kind of the new school, you know. Obviously the Tyreek Hill comp is going to be the one that you point to. But in terms of being a number one weapon and having an impact on the game, Ruggs is going to be able to do that even when he's not catching the ball, just because he's going to just take the top off coverage and open everything up for everybody else. So from that standpoint, I don't know that he's going to be a, you know, high volume numbers guy, but he's going to have the impact of a number one wide receiver. And I'm kind of curious on him, where if you pulled, and this would be a fun assignment for you, Bert, go pull some defensive coordinators and say, hey, watch these top three receivers and tell me which one you do not want in your division. I got a sneaky feeling that they would all come back and say it's Ruggs over the other two, just because of how much fear he can strike into a defense with that speed.
Yeah, and I think you get that answer on Tyreek too. It's sort of interesting that way. All right, let's get to the quarterbacks. You know, here's what I think's interesting, DJ. I sort of looked back at this the last few weeks, and I sort of noticed this is going to be 3 years running. The first quarterback taken was sort of a little off the radar, you know, going into his last year. in that you had Baker Mayfield 2 years ago. I think most people the summer before would have said like maybe a third or a fourth round pick. He winds up going first overall. Kyler Murray is the extreme example because he hadn't played much before his last year, and he was basically seen, okay, he's going to go play baseball. And now you got another one in Burrow who I think, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think like he would have been like a third or a fourth round pick based on where he was going into the summer. And then he comes out the way he's come out. And I'm just wondering from a scout's perspective what that tells you about the position. And if there's something in a draft room that maybe is worth talking about there where these guys are sort of, I guess, maybe developing at different paces, you know?
Yeah, I think it's different. I think the old, you know, the old Parcells rule with the number of starts and, you know, all the production and all those benchmarks that, you know, you want to hit in a quarterback, I think that's, it's kind of gone away. And, you know, some of it, the interesting thing, the other connection those guys have, they're all transfers. You know, you have all three of those guys with transfers potentially being the number one overall pick. So that's a relatively new thing where we've seen this ability to transfer, find good situations and really, really excel at that position. So I think times are changing, and I think, you know, you've got to just evaluate it for what it is. And I think with Joe Burrow, and I did him over the summer, and I gave him like a, you know, I have second, third round grade. But I remember talking to some people in August, and I think I even wrote about this, but it said that, you know, hey, who's somebody to keep an eye on? And they said, Joe Burrow is going to explode this year. You know, he wasn't fully, you know, totally healthy last year. The system didn't fit him. They love him at the school. And there was kind of, he was definitely one that was, like, keep an eye on him. Like, he's not completely off the radar. There's a chance this guy could really blow up, and that's exactly what happened. But I think each case you've got to do it individually and find out, you know, why did this happen so late? Why did it come on? I think with Baker, it was more of an acquired taste. He was always a really good player. I think you just kind of had to, you know, get comfortable with him. And then I think obviously Kyler didn't play, so there was nothing to go off of. You know, I had tremendous pedigree coming out of high school, so we knew the talent was there. And then with Joe Burrow, and I visited with him, and I asked him the question he's going to get asked by everybody at the combine, which is, how do you explain the jump from last year to this year? And it can't just be Joe Brady. And he had a really thoughtful answer. He said, you know, a lot of times grad transfers, most of them transfer in the spring. If not the spring, then the beginning of the summer. He said, I got to LSU after the freshman had already reported. So you talk about, you know, coming late to the party to try and not only learn the system real quick, learn your teammates, you know, fit in, get comfortable. And then when you look at the scheme that they had, so it was a lot of seven-man protection. They're only getting a couple guys out in the route, which limits his options, but also takes away the space he has to move around and use his legs because it's so crowded inside. And so it didn't really fit him. And then they get to this year, and he said they start out the year in a lot of six-man protection. Eventually it's almost all five-man protection. And his superhero trait is that he's got the vision to see the whole field in one picture. So to be able to get more guys out into the route, that's his best trait. And they unlocked that by the way they played. And I don't think that's just particular to Joe Brady. He's the only one that's going to get this performance out of Joe Burrow. I think whoever drafts him, you're going to want to get four and five guys out into the route in your system, because that's what he excels at. And that's what he does better than really anybody I've ever seen, especially at the collegiate level, of getting guys out, making good decisions, and being accurate with the football. So I think you have to do each of those situations with these kids that kind of have that one big year. You can't lump them together. You got to really study and find out the why.
I've heard a Tom Brady comparison with him, like, and I know athletically he profiles a little differently, but like I've heard, like, just pocket movement, like you said, vision, decision making, accuracy, that there actually might be a fair Tom Brady comp there. Do you buy that?
Yeah, and I'm already prepared for the backlash on Twitter because I know it's coming, Bert. Because at the combine, when they asked me for my comparison, I mean, how does this sound when you say somebody's a more athletic version of the greatest football player of all time? You know, that's what he look. Kevin Falk is there at LSU. He played with Brady. He's been around Joe Burrow. He's told every scout that comes through there, this guy's just like Tom. Mechanically, he's just like Tom. He functions in an offense where we just talked about getting guys in the route, good decisions, accuracy, you know, all that stuff. Very similar to Tom. He's got mechanically, I mean, he looks just like him. And I believe he's spent some time with Tom House, who's been with Brady. So There's a lot of similarities there. Now, I think Brady's arm's a little bit stronger. I think Joe Burrow is a better athlete. But, you know, Tom Brady was a sixth-round pick. This kid's going to be the first overall pick. We know what, you know, what Tom became. But I hate it when you do, when you get, you know, kind of put in these spots of some of these comparisons. But that's the best one I can come up with because there are a lot of similarities between the two.
Who's your number two quarterback? Because obviously Tua, and it's so interesting because I kind of look at it and I see Tua and Herbert, and it's like almost like the opposite. It's almost like when you decide which one you like better, you're kind of like giving a window into how you see quarterbacks, right? Because on one side, you've got a crap load of production, right? Like you've got feel, you've got accuracy, you've got like just all the intangibles, everything else, right? But you've got the injury. And then with Herbert, you've got clean medically, physically, like looks like an athlete, right? Big, can put the ball wherever he wants to put it, athletic as hell, but like just like the production maybe doesn't match all of that, right? So and you're probably projecting a little bit with him. I'd assume, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, but I assume you guys have you probably have those guys 2-3 in some order. How do you see those two?
Yeah, I have Tua, and if to me, if the medical was clean, it's a pretty significant difference for me. Just because, you know, look, at the end of the day, accuracy, poise, decision making. That's, you know, that's the business that I believe in. You know, and when I look at Tua. Accuracy outstanding, poise outstanding, decision making outstanding. Then you add some playmaking ability that he has there. Now he's not a Russell Wilson athlete, but he can buy some time and he can create if he needs to. So I really love Tua's game. To me, it just comes down to whether or not, you know, health wise in long term specifically, what that looks like. I'm okay if you have to redshirt him a year. That doesn't bother me. I'd still take him in the top five. If they say, hey, you redshirt him a year, then he's going to be fully healthy and can have a long career. Totally worth it. But if there's, you know, some concern about longevity, that changes it. But, you know, based off of ability, I have Tua second. And then the fascinating debate to me is Love and Herbert. And I have them right next to each other. I think Jordan Love is a more natural thrower. He's just very fluid, very explosive. He can make plays off platform. You move him off his spot, he can still make some things happen. But you've got to digest the difference between 18 and 19. You know, he loses 9 starters, head coach, offensive coordinator, and the production goes in the toilet and the turnovers spike in a big way, playing a lot of hero ball. So that there's obviously concern with that. And then Justin Herbert is, you know, the size, the mobility, the arm strength, all that stuff's there. He guides the football as a thrower. That bothers me a little bit. He can be a little bit robotic at times. And I want to see more of that kind of aggressive attacking nature because he's got the skill set to do that. I almost wish you could kind of combine the two where Love be maybe a little less reckless and Herbert be a little more aggressive. But those two guys are right next to each other for me. And that's, you know, I haven't put that one in ink just yet in terms of how that's going to shake out.
Yeah, it's interesting because I heard a couple people say, and this is, and I'm going to bring up a name that I probably shouldn't bring up here, but, you know, I remember talking to somebody a few weeks ago on Love, and they said to me, watch out, like a handful of teams are really going to like Love, and what's going to happen is they're going to clam up about it, and they're going to try to keep it their own secret. And this person said to me, that's exactly what happened with Mahomes. Was that Mahomes, there were teams that liked him a lot more than they were letting on, and they were hoping that other teams wouldn't see what they saw. Do you see that in Love at all? And not, I'm not saying he's Mahomes, but like, do you see that at all where maybe there's something that some teams are really going to latch onto there, and it sort of becomes one of those things where he goes higher than we think he'll go because maybe it's hard to pinpoint which teams like him?
Yeah, I mean, I have him as the 20th player right now. So, I mean, that's just the ability jumps off the screen. I mean, he has got a live arm. And the Mahomes thing has been, I mean, that was the comparison even coming into this year when he's coming off of a big 2018 was this is going to be the next Pat Mahomes. Needed a little bit of refinement, but there was a lot to get excited about. The thing that's different, I would say, and this is coming from somebody who whiffed on Mahomes. Mahomes last year, I think he was 41 touchdowns, 10 picks. So he's plus 31 in turnovers. Jordan Love was plus 3. So, I mean, there was a significant difference in the production with the two players. and the decision making was, even though Mahomes had some crazy plays and some wild, reckless decisions, not to the level that Jordan Love has. Jordan Love's played way more reckless. So, but I do think I'm with you. I know teams. I've talked to teams that are very intrigued by Jordan Love and what they could do with him. And if you have confidence in your coaching staff that you can, give him, I think he'll need one of those redshirt years. Mahomes did as well, and really get him honed in mechanically. The payoff could be huge. So he's definitely an upside play.
Is there any other quarterback that you really like, that you like would look at and say, everybody's sort of missing the boat on him?
What's interesting is there's three guys really, and it's kind of sorting out these next three guys when you look at it. It's Eason, who's got just a huge arm, just a big, strong pocket passer who's got some bad habits in terms of some movement things in the pocket, which I'd like to see him clean up. But there's a lot of talent there. There's a lot of ability there, and I think he'll have some sponsors around the league. He's going to have some teams that really, are intrigued by him. You've got Fromm because of the intangibles. I don't think he fits everybody, but I think in the right spot, he can start and be a productive player. I was talking with Bucky the other day, Bucky Brooks on the podcast, and I was asking him about Jake Fromm versus somebody that Bucky had played with and Jake Delhomme, like kind of one of those guys with the right spot, good defense, good run game. And he's got some poise and some moxie, and, he can be a successful player. So I think he's got a chance there. And then the one, if you're asking me the one that's just that I'm intrigued by,
like way off the radar,
more than anybody else at the position, I'd probably say Jalen Hurts. I was just going through some of the numbers the other day. Did this report, looking at this report through PFF on some of the pressure performance, throws under pressure. And Burrow is far and away, I think it was 17 touchdowns, one pick under pressure. Everybody else is like four touchdowns, two picks, four touchdowns, six picks. Jalen Hurts, I believe, was nine touchdowns, two picks, and was actually pretty efficient. So while, I wish he would throw with more anticipation and timing and touch at times, that's a pretty good sign that when he's been under pressure, he's made some plays and performed. So we know about the athletic ability and the leadership and all that. I think he's one of those guys, he'll get in the room, and I think he'll really impress some people. Son of a coach and all that stuff's going to play well for him. So he's one I would keep an eye on. I think that might be one of those ones that goes a little bit higher than everybody has anticipated.
Okay, couple last things then. Is Chase Young far and away the best player in the draft? I know, and it's interesting because when I talked to Duke Tobin and Zach Taylor about this, Duke basically said it, like Zach intimated it, that there are four guys that are looking at, three of them are quarterbacks, and then the fourth one is Chase Young. And so I've sort of gotten this feeling that like they've been intimated by a lot of people that he's sort of separate from the rest of the class. Do you see it that way? Do you think there's a big gap between Chase Young and the next non-quarterback?
I think Chase Young is phenomenal, and I have him as the number one player in the draft. I think he's the best player in the draft. But I think Derek Brown from Auburn's pretty special, man. He is right behind him for me. And, I got a lot of the same vibes watching Derek Brown as I got watching Ndamukong Suh, which is how he dominated at Nebraska. So I think Derek Brown is going to be an outstanding pro with his combination of just power and quickness, tenacity, effort, all that stuff's off the charts. So I have a higher grade on him than I had on Quinnen Williams last year. And I think, Chase Young's number one on my board, Derek Brown's number two. So I think he deserves to be up in the conversation, if nothing less.
Is there a gap after those two?
I have a little bit of a gap, but I have a collection of really good players. I mean, right behind that, I think Isaiah Simmons and Okuda are as good at their position as we've seen in a while. So those guys are outstanding. And then you get some of the upside players, with Kinlaw and, you get to, Xavier McKinney, Patrick Queen. Those are all really good players. But I'd say really Chase Young, Derek Brown, Okuda, and Simmons, those four guys, I think those are four, the four elite defensive players in this draft. And then there's a little bit of a drop.
Okay. Last thing for me. And I know this is sort of an abstract question, so take it, answer it, whatever way you want to answer it. But you've been doing this a long time. is like, and I'm sure like every year there's maybe one guy that really sticks out. That's my favorite guy to watch. That was my favorite guy to evaluate in this cycle. Do you already know who that guy is for you? Like who your favorite player to watch getting ready for this draft has been?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a couple. I mean, I can give you one that I think is a first-round type player, and maybe he'll go in the second round. But Brandon Ayuk from Arizona State, the receiver, is just so tough and competitive and explosive. You know, you try and put all these words together when you're writing them up and looking at him, and guy's just a baller, man. Like, he's just a football player. He has some drops, and that might ding him a little bit, but I want to be in the business with bringing in guys like that. So he would be one kind of in that top tier. And then if you're looking for somebody kind of in that third, fourth round range, a fun one that I just watched the other day was Amik Robertson from Louisiana Tech, who's, you know, he's going to be under 5'9". He's probably going to run in the mid 4.5s. So doesn't have the ideal height, weight, speed, but he's a day one nickel. He's got 14 interceptions, career interceptions. You watch him against Texas. He goes up against Colin Johnson, who's, what, 6'6", their big receiver. And one of the first plays of the game here, this little 5'8 corner just jumps him. And just a two-hand jam right in the chest. And it was like David versus Goliath. And he's just a scrappy, tough, instinctive, good football player. So he was one of the fun ones for me to watch.
Okay, he's Daniel Jeremiah. You can find him on Twitter at Move the Sticks, his podcast, which is great. He does with Bucky Brooks. That's called Move the Sticks, which is on iTunes, wherever you guys get your podcast. So be sure to check that out. And then you can check him out all next week on NFL Network. DJ, tell us a little bit about like your coverage and how all that's going to work, because it's all new this year, right?
Yeah, it's all new. We're going to prime time. So it starts the actual workouts begin on Thursday. I know we're on from 4 to 11. So we are on 7 hours every day. So we're going to have 28 hours of combine coverage. It's going to be, instead of a cereal combine, it's going to be a dessert combine, you know, no more early morning stuff. We're going to be out in the evening. So you can put the kids to bed and settle up and watch a bunch of guys run around. So it's going to be fun. We've got a great group. You know, Rich is the best running point, and get a chance to be with him and Charles Davis, you know, who's got so many, you know, stories and knows all these NFL teams so well. Kim Jones will be down on the sideline, you know, getting interviews, and then we'll have a bunch of players. I know Joe Thomas will be back. He did a great job with Sean O'Hara on the offensive line. Steve Smith is always entertaining with the wide receivers. Willie McGinnis, you know, we'll have all the players down there helping out as well. And I think I saw something. I think Jamal Adams might be involved this year.
Is that right? Well, you'll definitely want to check that out.
People jonesing for football, and the XFL give you, you know, scratch a little bit of that itch. I think you'll really enjoy the combine this year.
Awesome. Well, DJ is one of my favorite colleagues from the 6 years I spent at NFL Network. Always appreciate you coming out, DJ.
Appreciate you, bud.
All right, DJ's always awesome. Again, check his stuff out. Does a fantastic job covering the draft year-round for NFL Network. We're going to jump into the mailbag now. You guys know how this works. Even though I'm in Florida right now, we're doing this from the porch at our vacation house in Jupiter. So basically, every week we want you guys to connect to us so we can connect with you, so we can give you answers to all of your NFL questions. We've got two ways that you can do that. You can either email us at breermailbag@gmail.com. That's my last name, mailbag@gmail.com. Or, and we kind of prefer this because we want to hear your voice out there on the podcast, you can leave us a voicemail at 201-596-4346. So again, you can either email us at breermailbag@gmail.com, or you can leave us a voicemail at 201-596-4346. And now we'll bring in our executive producer, Shelby Royston. Shelby is the one who fields all the voicemails, all the emails. And Shelby, we'll jump right into it. Question number one.
From Jesse. Hey, Albert. A year ago, Quinnen Williams was considered one of the best three players in the draft. Did you hear any rumblings about him not being as good as advertised last year? If not, how did the league in general miss somebody so big?
What's his name, Shelby, again?
Jesse.
Jesse. Okay, thank you for the question, Jesse. I don't think that there was a question about his potential. I think the biggest question with Quinnen Williams, and you sort of heard DJ allude to it there, where he said he has a higher grade on Derrick Brown than he has on, than he had on Quinnen Williams. Well, one of the reasons why, Derrick Brown did it for multiple years at Auburn. What you see with Quinnen Williams was great. Like his, you know, that year he had at Alabama was fantastic. But he only had really 1 year of production. So that was the biggest question with him last year. There wasn't question about how well he played during that 1 year. There wasn't question about him athletically. There was just, why was it only for 1 year? And, you know, you could even go back to the Saban Belichick documentary if you guys check that out. And Belichick asked him at the pro day, who are the best players out here? And Saban's answer was, you know, the offensive lineman and the defensive lineman, meaning Jonah Williams and Quinnen Williams. So Nick Saban held him in that regard. And so I don't know if it's so much, you know, that there were these, you know, lingering doubts that were out there last year that have come to roost. Like the biggest question with him last year was, he's, you know, sort of a 1 year producer. So is it going to translate over to the NFL level? Has he not been challenged in certain ways? I think that probably left him with some holes in his game he's got to work out. I wouldn't give up on him yet. Question number two, Shelby.
From Eric, what options do the Rams have this offseason when it comes to cap, trades, and free agent signings?
Well, so the question I think for the Rams right now is, how are they going to fill out their middle class? Because they've become awfully top heavy with the guys they are paying. I don't know how you're going to get out of the Todd Gurley contract if you're the Rams. I think it's sort of a tough spot they're in. They may have to hang on to him for another year. So you've got Gurley, you've got Cooks, you've got Goff. You may have Whitworth back because he's going to be expensive to keep, but he may be part of that sort of upper class there. On defense, you've got Jalen Ramsey, you've got Aaron Donald. It's a small number of players that are elite blue chip players that are make your cap situation very top heavy. And so that makes it more difficult to assemble a middle class. The problem now is when you're assembling your middle class and you don't have a lot of money to spend, the best way to do it is to hit on draft picks. Well, you know, over a period from 2017 to 2021, they're going to be without a first-round pick, which shrinks your margin for error. So that puts a lot of pressure on Les Snead and his department to go and find cost-effective talent in the draft when you've taken the most valuable, you know, asset that they have 5 years running away in their first-round picks. And so, really, to me, I look at the Rams, and this is going to be about finding a way to assemble the middle class. And they've got some guys like Tyler Higbee and Rob Havenstein like that are under contract that do constitute that middle class. But finding a way to fill out, say, spot 11 to spot 53 on the roster and do it in a way that's cost-effective because they've spent so much on the blue-chip guys on their roster, it's going to be tough, man. I don't know that they can spend in free agency. You'd have to think it was going to be in the draft. And so it's going to be on them to find a way to hit on those guys in the third and fourth and fifth rounds. Question number three, Shelby.
From Wendell, as this is the last year of the current CBA, the same team can use both franchise and transition tag at the same time. Do you think some team, as the Cowboys with Dak and Cooper or the Titans with Tannehill and Henry, could use both mechanisms?
I think it's possible, and you brought up the two best examples of teams that might do that. You know, you look at the Cowboys, they've got a number of free agents. Dak, I think you'd have to franchise him because he's the one that, you know, you'd be at most risk for losing and most risk for there being a bidding war breaking out. But they've also got Amari Cooper. They've also got Byron Jones. There are guys at those positions for them. There are guys at important positions for them that are free now. And so maybe you slap the transition tag on one of them. The Titans, what are you going to do at quarterback? And are you going to go forward with Ryan Tannehill? Do you put the franchise tag on him? You know, with the idea, like, okay, like we're going to delay having to make a bigger decision on quarterback for a year with the franchise tag. Maybe we draft one, you know, to just sort of throw another dart at the dartboard. And then what do we do about Derrick Henry, who was the personality of our offense? That's a tough one. The trouble with the transition tag, and I would say this because it hasn't been used very much over the years in the NFL, and there's a reason why. The trouble with the transition tag is that it doesn't really create a huge deterrent for your rivals going after those guys. And so because there's no draft pick compensation attached to it, there's nothing stopping from another team from building a contract that's going to be really damaging to you from a cap perspective. You know, because they get the player, they get the player. Cause so they're obviously, you know, comfortable with the contract and they're not giving up a draft pick. And so I think some teams may use the transition tag. I would just question in this environment how effective using the transition tag is. There's another piece to that too, where if you're the original team, you're not getting a great benefit because you're not getting draft picks coming back and you're not creating that deterrent for other teams. There's also, you know, some players may feel antagonized when you put the transition tag on them because that they've gotten that far means you haven't been able to work out a long-term deal with them. And so maybe they don't want to come back if you put the transition tag on them. I know that's been out there. The transition tag is an option. I just don't know that it's an effective one. Shelby, question number four.
From Connor, with the Eagles being roughly $40 million under the cap with big questions surrounding Jenkins and Bradham, what direction do you see them going in and what type of players do you see them coveting?
They're in an interesting position because you've got Bradham, you've got Jenkins, and they're interesting players you got to make a decision on. I don't think they want to move on from Jenkins because he's been such a good leader for them, but obviously that would, you know, create some room if they were able to move on, if they were comfortable moving on from him. You know, I also, you know, I look at, you know, Alshon Jeffrey and what do they do with him? And they've been in such a bind at receiver. Like they may have to hold on to him, but there's a locker room issue there. And so, I think the Eagles are in a fascinating spot. And, you know, what's so interesting about it is I think that they're going to have a renewed interest, a renewed focus on drafting well. And if you look the last few years, they've been willing to trade away draft picks to bring in veteran players. I can tell you point blank, like their strategy is going to go in the other direction now that Carson Wentz is on a big contract. They took advantage of it, full advantage of the fact that they had that flexibility, having a quarterback on a rookie deal. You know, now going forward, their strategy is going to shift a little bit where their resources are going to go into the draft. And so, I mean, I wouldn't even rule out the idea that maybe they use some of those veteran players to build up some more draft capital because they know they maybe need to create a little more margin for error so that they can bring in some more cost-effective talent. And so, you know, it's interesting you compare the Eagles and the Rams, and we just got that Rams question. Well, the Rams, you know, went in on this strategy like, okay, like we're going to bring in veteran players. We're going to, you know, go out. We're going to go execute these big box trades. And, you know, we think draft capital is a little overrated. And they've gone forward with that even after paying Goff because, you know, they traded for Jalen Ramsey. The Eagles have sort of reined that back in as they've paid their quarterback. It'll be interesting to see 3-4 years down the line which strategy looks a little bit better with two quarterbacks that were drafted right next to each other in 2016. Shelby, question number five.
Finally, from Alex, heading into the draft season, I'd love to know more about what the keys to successfully drafting O-linemen have been in recent years. Who have been the best mid to late round pickups and what traits have been behind their success?
Okay, Alex, there are a couple things I would give you here, all right? Number one, and I thought this was really interesting, I think it was the Ravens. There are a couple other teams that have sort of noticed this, but the Ravens were definitely one where their analytics department came back and said, for one reason or another, Big Ten offensive linemen come into the league more prepared to play right away and wind up having longer careers. And I think some of the theory behind that was you see more, I guess, NFL-style football, obviously more in the running game in the Big Ten. And an example of the Ravens hitting on one was Ricky Wagner, who, you know, they got in, I believe, the sixth round, came out of Wisconsin, got him in the sixth round, wound up becoming one of the best right tackles in football. He winds up leaving there and going to the Lions. They wind up getting a comp pick in return. And so it kind of came full circle there where they use the analytics to draft the guy in the sixth round. It works out. They feel comfortable drafting offensive linemen to replace him because they do have this system in place and they get the comp pick on the back end. And so I do think there's part of that, like where do they come from? Like what part of college football are they playing in? What are they seeing on a week-to-week basis? So I think that there's that piece of it. You know, there's also, I think that the volume of starts and the volume of experience that these guys have, and I think offensive line is one of those positions where I've always heard this, number of starts is really important. And how much has a guy played? How much experience does a guy have? Was he playing from the time he was a freshman? And the reason why on that is because raw strength isn't just everything on for offensive linemen, it's playing strength too. And you build playing strength as you get more experience, you grow into your body, you learn how to use it a little bit better. And so I think those are the two things that I like have sort of stuck out to me over the years is, number one, where are they coming from? What conference are they coming from? Like Tristan Wirfs from Iowa, like he's going to benefit from, you know, like being a Big Ten offensive lineman because there are teams that are going to hold him in a higher regard because of that. And then number two, how long has a guy been playing? Has he been starting since he was a freshman? Does he have that? Has he had that opportunity to build up playing strength? So those are the two things that I would really look at as far as offensive linemen go. And we know the NFL is always looking for players at those positions. Shelby, that's it?
That's it for this week.
Awesome. Okay, well, thank you to Shelby, our executive producer, for bringing all the questions in. Appreciate you guys coming out. As always, we want your feedback. We're heading into the offseason. It's going to be an eventful offseason. And so we want you guys to tell us how we can be a better show. You can always get to me on my social media channels, at Albert Breer on Twitter, at Albert underscore Breer on Instagram, at Albert R. Breer on Facebook. And we want you guys to download and subscribe to all of our podcasts. And it's really, really easy to do that now. This time of year, we're going down to three times a week on the MMQB NFL podcast, but you're still going to get plenty of content there. We've got like the one podcast that's going to be, that was our Monday morning podcast that may move to Friday. We're still working some of that out. You've got Jenny and Connor's Weekside podcast. And of course, you've got this podcast, the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. And also, we've got a second feed, the MMQB MMQB news feed, which if you know you get out of work and you haven't been on the internet all day and you want to catch up on what's happened, well, you know, you can actually pop it in your car, get caught up, less than 5 minutes, you get to listen to everything MMQB, you get to listen to everything that's happened on the, in the news, in the NFL on any given day. So be sure always to subscribe and download and listen to the MMQB NFL podcast, the MMQB News podcast on Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, wherever you guys get your shows. Next week, we'll be in Indianapolis. I'll see you guys there.